Thursday edition. We'll just call it a Game 5 edition. Dennis Rodkin will either win or he'll go home. Dennis writes about real estate for Crane Chicago Business. He's in the studio. We'll talk to Ian Scher from CNET a little bit later, and then Elise Glink as well. Elise is going to, I think if we have time, we're going to talk about a story where Elise now, Amazon is allowing younger kids to shop on Amazon.com.
Oh.
There are these hoops, that, so you have to get a little parental approval. But, you know, it's like, hey, why not? Teach them how to, I mean, not six-year-olds, but I think 13 to 17-year-olds, get them in the habit.
Oh, yeah. It's like putting the kid's cereal on the lower aisle right. of the grocery store.
I read somewhere, it's like someone said, well, why do car commercials advertise at kids' cartoons? And they said because of the nag factor that kids will nag their parents and that it also brands kids.
All right. That's how you ended up with a Porsche.
It is exactly how I ended up with a horse. Did you say horse? okay, so Dennis writes about real estate. Let's go to Lake Forest.
Yeah.
I love the story. And we've talked about Lake Forest before, how their real estate market is sort of lagging. And it's not the sort of thing you think of when you think of a town like Lake Forest, but they have. And so they're undertaking this marketing campaign to get the young up-and-comers to move to their town.
Yeah. It's the slowest real estate market on the North Shore. One of the things to say is the North Shore is recovering a lot more or is moving a lot more slowly than the hot neighborhood, the affluent neighborhoods in the city, right? The city's is just going gangbusters in a lot of places, but the North Shore suburbs in many cases have really sort of been slow. Lake Forest for a couple of years has had a huge backlog of inventory, 13 months worth of inventory on the market, which is to say if nothing else came on the market today, it would take 13 months to sell off what's available.
And what's typical?
More like six.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
So it's pretty high.
And it's not because they're expensive homes? I mean, if affluent areas in the city are going faster.
Well, there's also the question. Some of the houses in Lake Forest have been put on at some pretty surprising prices. One recently came on the market at 7.9, sold for 6.4. So, you know, 7.9 million, sold for 6.4 million. So people, in many cases, are asking more than perhaps they should, given the market conditions. But on the other hand, real estate agents have often said to me, an affluent homeowner can afford to wait for their number to come. They may not even be living in the house.
Sure,
they
so it can stay on the market longer.
Yeah, they don't need to sell in order to buy the next house.
So what's the campaign like? What are they trying to do?
Essentially say, take another look at Lake Forest. So, you know, it's not only oriented toward home buyers. They also want you to come and look at it as a place to dine and things like that. I wrote about the real estate side of it because that's what I do. And a couple of agents and the Chamber of Commerce and others have gotten together and sort of rolled out this campaign. It's digital advertising. There are videos both on their site and available to real estate agents to put on theirs saying, Lake Forest is really sweet. Come take a look.
Are they one of the cities or towns that's putting, I know more and more are putting apartment complexes like right at the train station. Did they have one going?
They have condos directly across the street, yeah, that are selling pretty quickly.
Okay.
And, you know, that. And one of the things, here's one of the interesting tidbits they gave me when I was up there to talk about this campaign. According to the census, commute times from Lake Forest are shorter than commute times from Winnetka, which is more than 10 miles closer to the city. Part of that is because a lot of people from Lake Forest commute
right,
north to
right.
like Abbott and things like that. But one of the reasons it's interesting to have condos right by the train station is with express trains, you know, you can get downtown quite quickly from Lake Forest. So
okay.
They're trying to emphasize all of that.
And now I'm going to put on my little snarky hat because I want to take issue with a couple of their slogans.
Yeah.
And I want to take issue with one. So you included two in your story. One is Europe. It's 30 miles north of Chicago.
Yeah.
So come to Lake Forest because we're
a little European country village.
That's kind of fair, right? I mean, it is its own little downtown. And
well, yeah, you know, when you look at that, Market Square was based on European market squares.
Oh, really?
The downtown, yeah, when Howard Van Doren Shaw designed that, he sort of picked elements of many different countries and created this sort of village market square like you would see on a tour of Europe. But it also, I mean, I think what they're trying to do, you know, they've got all this great architecture and the big trees. And really what they're trying to do is say it's pretty far from Chicago.
Right. And then the second one I do have an issue with. Safety has found a home here.
Yeah. Tell me what your issue is with it.
Well, my issue is the implication. Well, first of all, I think we're all too afraid of danger.
Yeah.
It comes to be a holiday, have a safe holiday. What does that mean? I'm going to have a safe holiday. I think what they're saying here is don't live in those other places because they're not safe. I don't know. I don't love that.
It definitely plays on the. So, you know, one of the things I thought when I saw that one is they get a lot of people coming in. I'm an executive coming in from another country, another state. I don't know my way around Chicago.
Yeah.
But I have a lot of money in this particular case. And I've heard that Chicago is unsafe. So that like presses a button right away. And I think I would disagree, too, but with their choice of that. But it probably appeals to the kind of buyer they're looking for.
They're smarter than I am when it comes to marketing their town. So
yeah.
It's just not one I would pick. Okay, real quick, River Forest. I teased the fact that we're going to grow. I have friends who live in River Forest, and they're now the going price for a house is $3 million.
There is a two-block stretch of River Forest where there are four houses for sale at $3 million and up.
Wow.
Yeah, nothing has sold there for $3 million and up since 2008.
So four in a two-block stretch?
Yeah.
Well, that tells me there must be a really lousy neighborhood, a neighbor in that stretch, right?
Yeah, exactly. Everybody's two are brand-new houses built on the site of the really wonderful old Mars Mansion, which sparked a preservation battle when the news of demolition came along. And the other two are old home, really beautiful old vintage homes, all four for sale for over $3 million. If they sold all four, River Forest would be in this elite club of about six suburbs that have multiple $3 million sales a year. There really are very few.
Lake Forest in that club?
Lake Forest is in there. Highland Park, Glencoe, Hinsdale, not many others.
That's Dennis Rodkin, writes for Crane Chicago Business. Read more at chicagobusiness.com. We're going to take a break and come back and talk about some city projects as well. Dennis Rodkin is sitting just to my right. He writes about real estate for Crane Chicago Business. Okay, so let's go from Lake Forest into the city. And the most recent story you've written, I think, is this one about Renovo and how they are investing in Chicago housing. Explain that for me.
It's a really interesting organization. They just crossed 300. The reason to do the story is they just crossed $300 million in lending, primarily to rehab. Some of it is new construction, but their borrowers are these small-scale rehabbers, the people doing bungalows in South Shore and two flats in Auburn Gresham and things like that. So they have pumped, by their measure, $500 million in home improvement has happened with their lending because you borrow about 60%. They've lent $300 million, about $500 million has been
spent. Okay, so it reads like they're helping the little guy?
Yeah, they're helping the little guy, but they're helping the little guy help the neighborhoods.
Right.
Is really what it comes down to. It's rehab of foreclosed bungalows, of grandma's rundown house after she died, those kinds of things in the Garfield Ridges and the places I just named. I drove around with a guy in Humboldt Park who's doing both homes for people who've lived in Humboldt Park for a long time in the 199,000 range and homes for people you would call gentrifiers who are coming over from the other neighborhoods at $500,000 and $600,000. And all of this is sort of lifting up these neighborhoods. All those neighborhoods I've named, many more, with this infusion of cash lent by Renovo to these small operators.
Well, good for them. That reminds me, though, the city, we're always talking about affordable housing mm-hmm. in the city and when there's big developments, you know, units. And I know the city council, there's a movement before the city council for improving affordable housing. Explain it for me.
Well, so one of the issues has been that you were able to, under the last rewrite of the affordable, of the ARO, the Affordable Housing Ordinance is what it really is, you were able to, as a developer, either build some units in your location that are affordable and put some money into a trust fund, or build a few units off-site. Now what's going to happen in...
Okay, let me shortcut that. Okay. So what you're saying is that the rich people get to live in the new building and you get to put the poor people away from that new building.
Somewhere nearby.
Okay.
Yeah. Which might be easier. You know, there are stories about buildings in New York that conform to the affordable housing ordinance they have there where rich people come in to this beautiful gate, canopied and doormanned entrance on one side and then
the other
people come around through a little sort of like a garage door in the back. And that's what I think people are trying to avoid with rewriting the affordable housing ordinance in Chicago. In some target areas where things are happening really fast, developers would, first of all, they'd have to do more for affordable housing than they did before on a percentage basis. but they couldn't just put it into a trust fund because, as one alderman said to me, if I put that money in the trust fund, it doesn't come back to my ward. So it doesn't help solve the affordable housing issue in my ward.
I think critics would say then that would also stifle development, right? People would be less likely to do it.
Some people are concerned that that already development is slowed because of the ordinance and that it would be slowed further. That is a question. But some of the people who are supporting these changes would like to see development slowed because the more of the new expensive housing you build, the more of the old, less expensive housing gets torn down.
We were talking about that. I'm trying to remember. It was with Frank Sennett from Cranes last week.
Yeah.
And we were talking about if it was the income level or education level in the city is rising.
Yeah.
But that's because the poor people, many of them are uneducated, are moving out.
Right.
They're moving to the suburbs because they don't have a place to live.
That was a story by Greg Hines that was really interesting in Cranes.
Oh, that's right. It was Greg, yeah.
Yeah, it's we're the most educated city, becoming quickly the most educated city in America. But that's, you know, that would be a cool figure if it meant that everybody had more education.
Right.
Actually, what it means is, as you said, the less educated are being priced out of the city.
That's Dennis Rodkin. You can read more at chicagobusiness.com. Writes about this and a lot more at Cranes. Thanks for coming by.
Thanks, Steve.
Dennis Rodkin was just in here. And, you know, we've talked before. Dennis does these walking tours of Chicago, of the Loop, of the sexual history of Chicago. So the last walking tour of the year of his sexual history of Chicago walking tours is actually coming up this Saturday. If you're interested, he's got a website, sexualhistoryofchicago.com. So just give that a Google and you'll still have room. I meant to mention that when he was here, and I completely forgot. All right, Ian Schur is on the phone line. He is a senior editor at CNET.com. Ian, welcome back to the Business Lunch.
Hey, how are you doing?
I'm awesome. Thank you. Hi. And I've been asking people if they would be willing to give Amazon drivers a key to their house to drop their packages off inside, and they're saying yes. People are telling me that they're willing to do that. Amazon is in the works or in talking to not just key makers, or I'm not sure, they want to do it either to put packages in your trunk or maybe to be able to get into your house, right? Tell me about that.
Yeah, it's actually a really neat idea. So generally speaking, Amazon is trying to make it easier for you to deal with package delivery. I'm sure we're all used to getting those slips on our doors when you have FedEx or UPS and you're not there and they say, too bad, wait till tomorrow. But with Amazon, when they're delivering it, I actually get a phone call when I'm not answering the door. And they ask me, hey, are you going to be home soon? So this is the next step in that, which is where they are actually going to try and come up with a way where you can basically unlock your home or your car using an app whenever they need to drop off a package for you. And it's a really smart idea. It gets down to, you know, how do they get stuff delivered to you? Every time that you're not home, it costs them money. Just think about it, right? Time,
sure,
and gas to bring it back to the place and back again. So anything they can do to make that easier is a smart idea.
Okay, so so the homeowner would have the power to unlock the door from her app or his app. Is that what you're telling me?
Yes.
Okay.
I mean, this is just one of the ideas that they're working on. A similar idea would happen with the smart license plate, right, which is that, you know, maybe the license plate it contains a secure box where you can put the key to the car, or maybe you can unlock the box with your phone or grant others access. Like, there are smart locks right now for homes where you can actually, quote-unquote, grant someone access to your home, and all they have to do is walk up to your home, pull out their phone, and tap a button, and they're allowed in, even though they don't have a key. So there are a lot of ways that this can be done that are smart. Obviously, it has to be secure, or no one's going to trust it, but it's an interesting idea.
Yeah, what's secure mean? I didn't think anything was really secure anymore.
Well, okay, we can debate all that till the cows come home. But, you know, at least something where I can trust that, you know, I know that when I'm using a smart lock, that it's not going to get unlocked by some unsavory person, right? And that it's going to be something that I can rely upon and feel like it's safe and trustworthy to let Amazon do this.
Yeah, I guess, you know, I live in on a sleepy little street where I'm not too worried about people stealing packages. But I suppose if I didn't, I might be more inclined to do this. Or if I receive maybe a lot of packages or packages relating to business, it might be more appealing to me.
I'm the same way. I live in the middle of San Francisco. We're right next to a bus stop. So I tell UPS and FedEx never to deliver anything to my door. And I usually actually deliver stuff to my work, which is a pain for our...
I know, they love that.
They're nice about it. I bring them cookies every week so that they feel better sometimes.
I was going
to
say...
So, you know, I try to make it easier on them. But especially, like, during the holidays, it becomes a big deal. And so, yeah, something like this would make life way easier.
Okay, let's go to the baseball game. Cubs and Nationals are playing today, and it's roundabout way. But, I have noticed one of the things now, I am incapable of being away from my phone. I mean, I think maybe my pulse goes up a little bit if my phone is in a different room in my house. It's terrible. I'm not proud of it.
Yeah.
I don't like it, but it's absolutely the case. I've noticed it. And I've really noticed it watching the Cubs and watching the playoff games where, you know, baseball is a nice, easygoing, relaxing sport. Well, there's a lot of downtime. And I find myself reaching for my phone during commercials and then missing, much of the following inning and all of that. So there's that side. And so I'm like, well, I should put my phone down. The other side of it is I enjoy watching my phone with my Twitter feed to see my friends who are at the game or to see what other people I know are commenting. So in some ways, we've been told to enjoy things with social media, with our computers. But by the same token, we're becoming a little too tied to it. Now, you wrote... I don't know if you, but someone at CNET wrote about these digital detox vacations. I think I'm beyond that. I don't know if I can handle it.
Well, it's actually a really fascinating idea. So the reason that I started getting into this actually was that back when I used to cover Apple for the Wall Street Journal, during the Steve Jobs kind of death period, I was on my phone 24/7. I was constantly checking my phone. I was constantly responding to my colleagues in Asia. It was just nonstop. And so at one point, my wife said to me, we have to disconnect. We have to find a way out of this. And we decided that the only way to really be able to do that was to go on vacation to somewhere where there was no cell service at all. And so we found a little sleepy town up on the coast of California, no cell service, very bad internet. It was heavenly. And I started looking into this, and it turns out that there are a bunch of companies out there doing very similar things. They've actually identified places throughout the world where there's no cell reception. And they will bring you there for a vacation, including places like the Northern Lights. And if you are going somewhere where there is a lot of cell reception, they actually take your phone away from you. And they start, you know, part of this whole thing is they actually have kind of, I won't call it group therapy, but a group session on, like, how has your phone taken over your life?
Yeah, that's group therapy, Ian. That's what that is.
Well, look, some of us need it. And I'll tell you, I spoke with a doctor who, doctors have been, the pager that's on their side all the time. I spoke to one doctor who literally slept with her phone next to her pillow, even though she may not be on call.
Wow.
And that is, it's a level of stress and anxiety that is not sustainable. And, so this is something where once she did this, she felt like a completely different person when she was away from her phone for a few days. And that says something.
Yeah,
that we've gotten to that point.
I think you're right, and I mean I'm not kidding. I do need to step back from it a little bit because I pride myself in responding right away or answering right away, and I'm really tied to it. Okay, we've got 30 seconds left, but tell me about this Disney Movies Anywhere product, the program, and whether or not that's going to be something I'm interested in.
Well, I think you're definitely going to be interested. So there have been so many different places that you've been able to get a code and get a digital movie for, and whether it's iTunes or Vudu or Amazon or whatever. Now Disney has convinced a bunch of people to bring it all together into one app. And if this thing plays out well, and we have a story about it on CNET with all the details, it's going to possibly be the way that we download all of our movies in the future. And thank God at least someone has one way to do it, because I'm sick and tired of having a bunch of passwords for all these different services.
Ian Schur is a senior editor at CNET.com. Ian, great to talk to you. And I'll make sure that, I won't drop a package off at your house because it'll be ripped off, apparently.
There you go. Exactly.
I'll send the gift. The gift is in the mail to CNET's headquarters.
Thank you.
We'll talk again soon. It's the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Thinking of holiday shopping, the forecasts are already out. We'll talk to Elise Glink about that coming up. Steve Bertrand here on the Wintrust Business Lunch, 720 WGN. All right, is it too soon to say Black Friday? Last year, by one estimate or one calculation, we spent $55,818,000,000 in holiday sales. That's what we spent at the stores. The National Retail Federation says it's probably going to go up 3.6 to 4.4% next year. Elise Glink is on the phone line. She joins us from time to time to talk about economics, jobs, real estate, and all of that. She's also the publisher of ThinkLink.com and the CEO of Best Money Moves. Elise, welcome back to the Wintrust Business Lunch.
Oh, thanks, Steve. Nice to be here.
All right. Have you started your holiday shopping?
I haven't. I'm one of these more last-minute, do something sort of interesting and maybe make something for people kind of shopper.
Okay. You make.
What about you?
No, I have not started. Not, of course not. But so these estimates are that it looks like it could be a pretty good year. I looked over the numbers, right? Because I'm just not enough to know what the percentage increase is year over year, but I wanted to see what we did over the Great Recession. And if you go back to 2002, 2008 was the only year we went down. So 2007 was $525 billion. 2008, we dropped to $501 billion and change, up to $502 in 2009, and then jumped to $528 in 2010. But since then, we continually sort of spend more for each holiday season. Why do they think this year might be better than it was last year?
Well, there's a number of interesting things that may play in as we see the year continue. So first off, there's huge swaths of people in Florida and in places where the hurricanes have all hit, and now the fire has hit, which is just horrific what's going on in California. And I wonder how shopping is going to be in those communities when they're trying to replace houses, they're not living in homes. My thinking is that they may try and spend more money at Christmas because it's a fast fix, and it would be interesting to see if that does come into play.
So you think the mm-hmm. losses that they've suffered might actually lead to bigger holiday sales?
I think it's possible that in those communities, and we'll want to watch it, that parents who are now out of their homes are either, maybe going to spend a little bit more because their kids have nothing anyway. And so replacing those items may come in the form of, holiday gift giving. But, if you're giving somebody a basket of socks because all their socks, are gone, I'm not sure it's quite the same thing as getting the new Game Boy or Xbox. I think that also, one thing for us to look at is, of course, the stock market is just at record highs. Housing is back. We've got record high numbers of valuations in houses across the country, and we're seeing continual pushing up of home prices due to shortages of homes being listed for sale. So that makes people feel good, especially the stock market being so high, and we're also seeing wages go up for the first time in quite a long time. Last year, there was a fairly meaningful rise for families. And that's expected to continue this year. And so I think people are going to channel that into buying.
That raises a good question. I mean, I think it's a good one. It's mine. But what is it that prompts people to feel good and spend more? If the stock market keeps going up as it has, I don't know that that has a direct impact on my day-to-day income or ability to buy things. But you're saying that will lead me to spend more money?
I think the people feel better about their overall state of finances if they have, only half of Americans have investments in the stock market. But for those that do and are working and they have 401ks, just the thought that that money is growing makes you just feel better emotionally. And so they may be more likely to go out and spend money on a credit card. And we're seeing the number of credit cards rise dramatically, even as people are nervous about credit. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. But we do have more people in the States. We have, more money that's flowing into people's pockets. That tends to leak out around the holiday season.
We need more credit cards so we can buy online. Deloitte says that online holiday sales will be up 18 to 21%. That's a big jump.
It's a huge jump. And it doesn't really surprise me because if you look at the numbers of retail stores that have gone out of business, and you and I have had this conversation any number of times over the last year and a half. I mean, you're seeing just whole store chains close down overall. And the stores that seem to be doing the best are stores like dollar stores.
Right.
Excuse me. So I do think that if, you're seeing the number of retail outlets shrink, more of that is already moving online in general. I just think it's a natural extension that we're going to see online holiday shopping pop.
That is Elise Glink, the person behind ThinkLink, and check out bestmoneymoves.com as well. Do that today. Elise, nice to talk to you.
See you next week.